Hello, everybody. Welcome to Health Chatter. Good morning. Good morning. Today we have an interesting topic, and I'll profess, I really got educated just reading the research about this, and we'll hear more about it. We're going to be talking about post-traumatic stress disorder in young women with a special guest today. And so stay tuned on that. We have a great crew, as always. Maddie Levine-Wolf, Aaron Collins, DeAndra Howard, Matthew Campbell, Sheridan Nygaard are all our background crew that do excellent work with us. They've been here since day one on Health Chatter, and they are dear, dear colleagues. They do all the recording for us, the background research, production, marketing, the whole nine yards, and they're second to none. So thank you to you all. And Maddie just turned 30, so happy birthday to you, Maddie. Also, Clarence Jones is here. And he'll be chiming in as my co-host, along with Dr. Barry Baines, who will provide a little bit of a medical, maybe a little bit of a medical perspective on this subject today. Again, two great colleagues and friends, so thank you to you as well. Human Partnership is our sponsor for Health Chatter. Wonderful community health organization. Check them out at humanpartnershipalliance.org. That's HUEMAN partnershipalliance.org. And check us out at healthchatterpodcast.com for all the different shows that we've done. And we've done quite a few, and you can read the research, and you can either read transcripts of the actual shows or listen to them as an actual podcast. So thanks to everybody again. So today we're going to be talking about PTSD in young women. We have a wonderful guest from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Ida Fonque is a tenure track assistant professor in the physical therapy division, Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota, Director of the Neurobiology of Emotion, Sleep, and Trauma Lab, where she and her team study neurocirculatory and hormonal mechanisms linking trauma and cardiovascular risk in women. That's a mouthful right there. But it's an interesting subject, and we're going to be talking about PTSD. And I've got some maybe twists and turns as far as questions about this. But thank you for being with us, Ida. It's wonderful having you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Let's start out with, for the listening audience, I think most of us have maybe just heard PTSD, okay? But maybe we should clearly get a definition of what it really, really is. So let's start with that.
So post-traumatic stress disorder, and this is a disorder that was commonly associated with the military before, but it's a psychological disorder that often develops after a traumatic event. Symptoms that are usually associated with traumatic events, losing sleep, re-experiencing avoidance of places or people that remind us of the trauma. But the particularity of PTSD is that about 50% of those who experience those symptoms after trauma will actually go on to have the same symptoms 4 weeks later. So there's two important things that needs to be considered for the diagnosis of PTSD. The traumatic event, it's important. And second, the length of the symptoms, so about 4 weeks minimum. Because PTSD is in fact a diagnosis of extension, which means everybody who experiences those symptoms after trauma, but just a handful, like I said, 50% of individuals will go on to after 4 weeks to continuously develop that. And one of the disclaimer I want to give here is that I am not a psychiatrist or a clinical psychologist. I am a cardiovascular physiologist. So I don't diagnose PTSD. Participant comes to me with a diagnosis, but my goal is to really show them it's not all in their head and see what's happening in their heart, blood vessels, and metabolism.
So, one thing that as I was reading this, it's like what can kind of lead to an event, a trauma event. So, for instance, there might be somebody who's actually had the event one way or the other. And then there might be others that are linked to the person that had the event. So, for instance, I keep thinking, what came to my mind when I was reading about this is okay, there are wars going on around the world right now. And somebody in a family, for instance, might get injured or God forbid, killed. Okay, so if they're injured, they might experience PTSD after that. But then what about a family member? Is there like kind of a complementary PTSD that can go within a family?
It's a good question you ask. And I like to use example. I had an example of a participant who came to us and had ex her own experience of trauma, and it was more of an interpersonal. I want to give a disclaimer here if I use some words that can be triggering for other people. So this was a sexual assault that was the traumatic event for this young individual. However, after she completed the survey, because although we don't diagnose, we have a survey that we give our participant to determine the severity of the different symptoms that I mentioned earlier, like hypervigilance, avoidance, hyperreactivity, sleep problems that usually come from it, which is part of the re-experiencing. Now, after she completed the survey, she asked me a question. She said, "Well, can I complete another survey?" And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I feel like I had two traumatic events in my life. I have what happened to me, and I had the trauma that I went through from listening to my mother share her own traumatic event while she
Interesting.
was in the military. So her mother was in the military, and I'll probably touch on this later, which is one of the reasons why I study civilian women, civilian as opposed to military. But her mother was in the military and experienced trauma that was not related to war. It was within the military. And later on in her life, her mother felt like she was old enough for her to share this experience with her. However, this ended up being very traumatic for her listening to her mother tell her own trauma. So, yes. It is, you don't have to, and that's why one of the question that we ask in the questionnaire is, did it happen to you? Was it linked to a threat of death, or because many people probably were traumatized by watching the video of George Floyd being murdered, and we are around the anniversary of that right now. So you can experience it. There's a secondhand, just like secondhand smoking. You can have that secondhand trauma from watching somebody else being traumatized or hearing somebody else's story of trauma.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, you can relate to that. Hold on, Claire. I can relate, you're like Holocaust survivors, and then they tell their story to their children, and then their children kind of go through, I can imagine, can go through what you're talking about. Clarence, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ida, thank you for that. You started off with something that I wanted to dive into, which was about your journey into this topic. I think you had started to saying that. So could you just kind of share with us as much as you choose to about your journey into this topic?
Thank you very much. I have a medical degree from Cameroon, and this is a story I haven't really shared. Growing up, and I had a younger sister who had sickle cell disease. And anybody who knows anything about sickle cell will know these are patients that are in the hospital every month. And when I started medical school, even if you're a first year medical student, you become the doctor of the family. So I became this person who was responsible of my sister, and unfortunately, she has passed away now. But I was the one when I finally realized my father was tired to always carrying this burden of her being with her. I said, "Hey, I can take over. I can help." So for the longest, until I moved to the United States, because I'm originally from Cameroon, I was like my sister's caretaker, and I could never sleep anytime she had one of her crises. So in hindsight now, and I feel like my father had an undiagnosed case of PTSD, because never knowing if this child is going to make it out of the hospital this time is very traumatic for a parent. And that happens with parents with children with cancer or any type of chronic disease. So I moved to the US and I did a PhD in integrative physiology. And during my PhD, I decided to study stress. I just wanted to see the effect of stress on the heart and blood vessel. I've always been interested in internal medicine. Working with Dr. Carter at Michigan Tech, I did my PhD at Michigan Tech. We looked at how acute stress through mental stressors using a serous obstruction, mental arithmetic. So we basically had people do math acutely in the lab while they were hooked on many equipment, looking at their nerve, which is the fight or flight response, looking at their heart, their blood vessels, their breathing. So we were recording all of that while we stressed them with mental math acutely, serious obstructions. When I was done with my PhD, thinking again about the story of my father and my younger sister, because even though I had moved here, my sister was still back home, and my father now had to, like, the little break I gave him when I was there, now he was back being the one not sleeping, if I could say. So I decided to move and do a PhD where I'll study the effect of post-traumatic stress disorder. At the time, I didn't put a name on it like that. I was really interested in chronic stress. Like I studied acute stress. I wanted to see what happened with chronic stress. I spoke to this physician who was at Emory during one of my conferences, and she said, "Well, I studied PTSD." And I said, "Well, can you tell me more about it?" And I read more about it, and I thought, "Well, this is a disease of the military." I thought this is a disease of the military. Well, that doesn't really connect. But as I started to learn more about it, I'm like, this is a chronic model of stress. So regardless of people in the military experiencing it at war, I really want to see what it does to the cardiovascular system. Fast forward 3 years after my postdoc at Emory, it was time for me to become an independent faculty. And I had been listening to the stories of women in the military. What was striking to me was that the women in the military did not report witnessing war or being in combat as the reason why they were traumatized. For the men, it was the case. So we had a questionnaire called combat exposure questionnaire. Men will score high, but women, no. And as I started to investigate more, I realized, and we were all aware of this, it's not a secret. There's a lot of interpersonal abuse that used to happen, and hopefully it's a little less now for women in the military. So there was a lot of abuse between rank, and women not being able to express certain things. And so I thought, well, I think I really want to focus on women, because whether women are in the military or outside of the military, they share this common interpersonal nature to their trauma. That's how I ended up where I am today, where I focus on PTSD, but mostly from interpersonal from an interpersonal cause or origin. So I hope I was able to, like, brush these were 9 years that I kind of trying to sum up in a
You
few minutes
did.
here. Yes.
You did very, very. You did very, very well. Thank you
Thank you.
for being willing to share that.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. As you were talking, my dog got stressed out because the recycling person is here.
Hey,
So,
we all have our causes of
no kidding. So, there's a whole bunch of different things that kind of came to my mind. One thing that obviously you're touching on, Ida, is comorbidities, right? Okay, especially in the cardiovascular arena, which I'm aware of because of my background. But let's talk about that a little bit. So it's one thing if you're diagnosed with PTSD, but you're studying kind of the linkages with comorbidities in the case of cardiovascular disease. So, can you touch on that a little bit for us?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to again start back to when I was studying veterans. I was a WOC, federal employee. What we call WOC is work without compensation. So I was employed by Emory, but I was actually working at the Atlanta VA. And studying predominantly African American male veteran, what we noticed is that those with post-traumatic stress disorder had a high, again, we call it sympathetic nerve activity, but it's your fight or flight. Higher fight or flight activity at rest, tend to have higher resting heart rate. And in response to stress, they even had, these are all, by the way, these are what we call in the field cardiovascular risk factors. Having a high resting fight or flight, having a higher resting heart rate, and having a higher response to stress. In this case, we stress them using, again, MAT acutely. It's like using an acute stress on top of a chronic existing stress. So what we saw was that this veteran with PTSD had about three or four what we call independent risk factor for cardiovascular disease. High inflammation. Inflammation, it's supposed to be when you have a fever and inflammation. However, low grade inflammation, you're not necessarily having a high temperature, but your cells are feeling like are under stress. They feel that temperature even if you don't feel it. So we saw that high inflammation, high fight or flight response, blunted cardiovagal baroreflex, reflex, which means your baroreflex is the ability of your nervous system to like regulate your blood pressure. When it's high, your fight or flight should go down. When blood pressure is high, when it's low, your fight or flight should go up so that blood pressure can go up. So this was dysregulated in this in patient with PTSD. And then finally, what we saw in this individual with PTSD is that your rest and digest system, which is your parasympathetic nervous system, was not doing a good job at keeping heart rate down. So that was impaired as well. So you have in just one group of individuals, you have four different, and this is for what I can we study, four different risk factors. So it's like a four, I want to say double whammy, but this is triple. I don't know what you say when it's quadruple whammy. So you have four risk factors in one individual. So moving forward, looking at women, the one of the reasons why young women that I study, we call premenopausal women. These are women between the ages of 18 and 40 years old. One of the reasons why this group is very interesting is that, as you will know, women before 40 years old or before menopause, if we use 40 as the age of menopause, for some women it could be later. Women before menopause are expected to be protected from all these cardiovascular diseases because of the hormone called estrogen. I call estrogen the happy hormone. Makes your blood vessels soft, calm down your fight or flight response, allow your rest and digest to be higher, and then cools off inflammation. Have a good control on cortisol. Everybody knows cortisol as that hormone of stress. But, well, this is what people used to think. Now with PTSD, in my study, I'm seeing something different. I'm seeing that these young women almost have the physiology of women who have reached menopause, even though they're still young. And because the we recruit women that are someone that are beside the diagnosis of PTSD and some comorbid depression, these are women who are healthy. So it's like the question here now is, what is PTSD doing to estrogen? What is the interaction between PTSD and estrogen? Is PTSD rendering estrogen, rendering the blood vessel and other organs less sensitive to estrogen? Or is PTSD lowering the level of estrogen, right? Which menopause is basically that lowering of the level of estrogen. So there's the normal comorbidity that we've seen in PTSD, particularly men or women a little bit older. But it's really scary to see what's happening in young women that were thought to be protected from cardiovascular disease.
Wow, that's a really interesting finding. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And Ida, one of the questions I have is, once someone develops post-traumatic stress disorder and they have these neurocirculatory and hormonal responses, all of us live lives where we're constantly exposed to mi at least mini stresses, or,
Yes.
but it can become cumulative. So my question is, once someone has post-traumatic stress disorder, does the neurocirculatory and hormonal system like maladapt to a response? In other words, that the post-traumatic stress sort of primes, their hormonal and neurocirculatory system to respond in a particular way. And then that becomes that even with little stresses, it's sort of they become overloaded because the body learns that response. And so I'm just wondering if that's something that you've seen, sort of following people, because it's pretty scary to think that young women, chronologically, they're 18, 20s, 30s, and yet physiologically, they're really showing up as being much older than that as a result of the stress response. So
Thank
I hope
you.
that
It
makes I hope that makes
makes
sense.
sense. Thank you, Dr. Benz, for that question. I think you said something there about physiological, it's like your physiological age versus your real age. I think that's a very, and I think we, that's the case for metabolic diseases too. They always talk about your physiological age versus your metabolic, your actual age. The question you just asked right now, in regarding young women that I'm studying at the moment, I will stay tuned because I'm still analyzing that data in terms of how, because we have that acute stress that we do in the lab, and I'm trying to see how the fight or flight response and the blood pressure changes. I already see this high at rest, right? You always start higher, but I want to see if once you're stressed, do you even have a higher response than your peers? And your peers here, we chose to recruit women who have been exposed to trauma but did not develop PTSD as a control group. So everybody who come to my lab have had exposure to trauma. Some did not develop PTSD, others did. And so our flyers do not mention PTSD actually. Our flyers mention trauma. You, they self report their own diagnosis. Mental health diagnosis. So yes, we the jury's still out of that. We want to see what's happening. But on the vascular side, I want to say this because we have already published data on the vascular side, how the blood vessel responds. We saw that in response to stress, these young women have higher vascular constriction. It's like your at rest, we saw that the vessel was a little bit stiffer already. So we saw that in response to stress, there was and increased vasoconstriction. So I wanted to add to the question Dr. Baines asked regarding like this overload. When I was a PhD student, I study black men, black young men, and I compare them to Caucasian young men. Because we know that race, family history of hypertension, those are considered, at least race is a non-modifiable risk factor for hypertension and family history of hypertension too is you can change your family history. So What we saw is that in young men, contrary to what I thought that young black men with a family history of hypertension, that young black men with a family history of hypertension will have a higher MSNA response. MSNA is the fight or flight. But we saw the what we saw was actually the opposite of what we expected, as if there was a ceiling effect. So at rest, this young black male had higher fight or flight response than the Caucasian age match counterpart. But after stress, we did not see that higher response that we expected. So we were wondering if there was some sort of a ceiling effect, as if was so high that it couldn't go higher. But with the vascular, what we're seeing in young women here with this vasoconstriction, so vessel getting tight. You know what happened with vasoconstriction is that if your vessels are tighter, which is what vasoconstriction is, and they can really open up and be flexible and adapt to an influx of blood that is coming when you're stressed. Because when you're stressed, you need more blood to go to your muscle, to go to your brain. You have to think, you have to run if you need to run. So vasoconstriction is not what we want at that time because blood pressure is even going to go higher. We want blood vessel to be able to adapt to that flow of blood coming in. So we're seeing in these young women already something that is abnormal in the response of their blood vessel to stress. So I'm really interested to see what we'll see with the fight or flight. Are we going to see what we saw with black men, where there was like already a plateau effect, or are we going to see the trend that we're seeing with vascular function, which is higher fight or flight in response to stress?
So my question is level of trauma. What kicks in to an actual diagnosis of PTSD? In other words, if somebody just witnesses something, or if somebody is actually attacked, or if somebody is hurt, what at what point, medically speaking, does what events, I guess, have to indicate PTSD? I assume that some people are in that state, PTSD state, with a fairly minor trauma, where others kick into the diagnosis of PTSD with more major trauma. So how is it that as when we diagnose this, we make that distinction?
That's a good question you're asking. And again, my disclaimer is that I'm not a clinical psychologist. But what I will say is that the gold standard for the diagnosis of PTSD is called the clinician-administered PTSD scale, or called CAPS. The reason why is a clinician-administered one is because it's not a survey. You're not given a survey that you answer. It's an interview. It usually takes about an hour and a half. And I know this because I work with the Grady Trauma Project in Atlanta. It's the largest civilian trauma project. They've been around for almost 20 years now and have more than 15,000 participants, mostly women. And it's in downtown urban Atlanta, Grady. So this interview takes about an hour and a half, and usually it's recorded because it allows the clinician to also go back and review it and check. So it's not just your answers, it's also how you answer the question. And then, just like an interview, they can probe further. They can probe further into question and into things you say. So that's the gold standard for the diagnosis. However, and the diagnosis is made on, and I don't want to go into what I know about the criteria for diagnosis because Given that I'm not a clinical psychologist, I don't want people to start diagnosing themselves. It's important to know that there are criteria that the clinician will pay attention to. There are categories of symptoms, right? You have symptoms that relate to mood, affection of your effect on your mood. You have questions that relates to how the re-experiencing of these symptoms. You have question on your hypervigilance. You have question on avoidance. They have a criteria of how many of this symptom you need to have, plus how many of that one in each category to be able to meet the threshold. There's a number because each of those questions and how you answer them have a number. And the total, there's a threshold where they can say you're borderline, you're mild, you're moderate, you're severe. So it's at the discretion of the clinical psychologist to make that diagnosis. Actually, sideline here is one of the reasons why, because a diagnosis of PTSD in the military come with some sort of disability benefit and all of that. So sometimes there's say controversy, then and sometimes we'll get those diagnoses and we doesn't, because sometimes it's at the discretion of the clinical psychologist. But the most important thing for the diagnosis is always that traumatic event. It's like a detective going to a crime scene. If there's no crime, there's no investigation. So it always starts with that traumatic event. Gunshot, maybe, where you were. And it starts early in children. We all know interpersonal trauma. So it could be interpersonal trauma. It can be natural event. It can be war. It could be, there's a lot under interpersonal. Neglect could be one. Adverse childhood event. Neglect is part of adverse childhood event. So it's complex, but it's important to know that there's a traumatic event. There's the symptoms that you have, how many of each of those categories you checked. How long have you had them? I said that earlier. How long have you had this? If you experience a trauma today, everybody will have the symptoms tomorrow or in a week. So we won't be diagnosing everybody with PTSD. That's why that length of at least 4 weeks is important. So if I suppose if you come to a clinical psychologist soon after a traumatic event, they'll probably want to see you later. And when they see you later, they can now reevaluate and see if you still meet the criteria for PTSD after this length of time has passed. And now you can get the formal diagnosis.
So there's a scale.
There is a scale. There is a scale called the Clinician-Administered PTSD scale.
Another question I have is societal things that happen or that we are all involved with. Like, there's a lot of stress, frankly, that's going on. Like, for instance, across the United States now, for whether it's for instance political or economic, or people are getting deported or what have you, all these issues. Are those considered trauma-oriented things, or is it like if they're here today and gone tomorrow, it's not? But on the other hand, if these have longer lasting implications, does that fall under the definition of PTSD, or does societal things like that really not part of the definition?
That's a good question you're asking. Although we don't diagnose, we use a questionnaire called the PTSD checklist to be able to determine the severity. And one thing that I know is that in the instruction, they particularly ask you about an event. And I was trying to read the instruction right now. This is what, and a great thing should have been to have that questionnaire right here with me, and I know someone might bring it to me. It says, Please list the, well, this is for the severity. So we mostly focus on the last 3 weeks for the severity. But it's not any type of stress. I mean, being chronically stressed is not necessarily a traumatic event. I want to really, because people talk about I'm stressed all the time, I'm stressed all the time. No, it's not because you have a chronic stress that you necessarily will develop PTSD. So I think let's start here by pointing out what the instruction for this PTSD checklist says. And the PTSD checklist is not used for diagnosis. It's used for to evaluate the severity of PTSD after the diagnosis was made. So it says this questionnaire asks about problem you may have had after a very traumatic experience involving actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence.
Got it.
It could be something that happened to you directly, something you witnessed, or something you learned happened to a close family member or close friend.
Got it.
Some examples are serious accident, fire, disasters such as hurricane, tornado, or earthquake, physical or sexual attack or abuse, war, homicide, or suicide. Because you can get PTSD from a friend committing suicide. I've actually had many participants who still live with the, I couldn't do anything about it. So they say, first, please answer a few questions about your worst event. And the reason why this questionnaire specifies worst event is because it's sad to say this, but children who experience this early childhood adverse event go on to compound many, many trauma. So some of my participants endorse about five different types of trauma. And that's why this questionnaire is telling them, answer a few questions about your worst event, which means the event that currently bothers you the most. And this could be one example above. So the example that we listed. So not only do you write down exactly the event, you write down how long it happened, you write down if it involved actual death or threat of it or death, because death could be someone who died or threat could be yourself. How did you experience it? You need to let us know if you witnessed it happen to you, you learn about it happening to someone else, or you were repeatedly exposed to details, which is what happened with the George Floyd. We were always seeing it on TV. So I had to make sure that I basically turned off the TV so that I raised a black son. I didn't want him to continuously see that on TV. And if the event involved the death of a close family member or close friends. So I went over exactly what we asked them to do and what we read. I think this is important for people to understand that I can't just say, oh, I think I have PTSD. I'm too stressed. No, this is undermining what really happened to people who actually have PTSD because this is such a debilitating disorder. One thing I should have pointed out from the beginning, this is a debilitating disorder. These are people who have a hard time functioning, like you and me, getting up in the morning, getting in an elevator. There are people who don't take elevators unless they have somebody else. And if they take an elevator, the last person who get out, they get out. It doesn't matter what floor it is, because they can't be left in there by themselves. These are people who can't go to work. As soon as they get out, it's stimulation everywhere, and they have to go back in and call off work, and that's why they can't keep a job. So it's not a diagnosis to be taken lightly.
So basically you're defining certain parameters that really put you into the diagnosis of PTSD. As you were explaining this, cousins of mine lost their home in Pasadena, due to the fires. And I've been in contact with them, and they're seemingly A-okay. They're good spirits and everything else. But on the other side, I asked myself, Wow. How about some of the families that experienced that event, and how are they moving forward? And I'm assuming that in that particular case, like you mentioned, there could be earthquakes, fires, what have you, that there are going to be some people that are going to be experiencing PTSD because of that event that happened so acutely. Barry, go ahead.
Trying to go to a more positive side of this, just from the perspective of what we can do or what people can learn about resources for this. It looks like in the research that one of the things that really reduces the likelihood of developing PTSD is a personal resilience that people have, which is, it's very individual. But taking it a step further, and I don't know, Ida, if you get into this with your research, but with the measurements and the whole, again, back to the neurocirculatory and hormonal responses, have you tried or looked at different interventions that might either minimize or reduce that response? Things like, I mean, that I'm thinking of is meditation, helpful, deep breathing exercises, just things that are general stress reliever strategies. But I wonder how that plays into the more serious and more significant types of responses, like with PTSD.
That's a very good question. I know people want to make everything about genetic. Like this, some people are more resilient, and there is a level of resilience. And what the studies have shown, not my particular study, but studies have shown that community is actually one of the most important aspect of resilience for many individuals. Two individuals exposed to the same trauma, same time. One goes on to develop PTSD, the other one doesn't. And when I talk about community, it starts at home, the family unit, and then grows into the community, the bigger family. The support can be teachers, it could be coaches, it could be anybody, role model the child is surrounded with or the individual is surrounded with. So community is an important aspect of resilience. When it comes to intervention that may be been done, particularly that I was part of, to reduce this physiological response that we see. At Emory, we did a study using a device-guided breathing. A device-guided breathing is any people who are trained can sit down and meditate and control their breathing, but not everybody can do that. So the advantage of this device is that it was paired to music. And it had a biosensor belt on your chest, so it could really tell if you were really taking in deep breath. And you pair that to music. There was music for inspiration and music for expiration. And we had a sham group that we also gave a different type of music to. So the group that we were testing had to breathe about 6 breaths per minute, which is kind of low. 6 breaths per minute is low. And the control group was at 14 breaths per minute. Normal individual is between 12 and 15. So what we saw with this intervention is that acutely, while they were breathing, we were measuring the fight or flight response. We have an electrode that we put in the nerve just behind the knee, and I do that also in my lab. And we could see that fight or flight response decrease in response to the breathing. We could see that response in the breathing. This was acutely. We also sent them home with the device for 8 weeks. And when they came back, we saw that those who had the real device for 8 weeks had a slower fight or flight response to this mental mat we gave them in the lab compared to those who use the sham device. So there's something about breathing, yoga, being able to control your breath during a stressful event, because there's the traumatic event, but there will be a lot of acute one throughout your life that can remind you of that traumatic event. For those who went to war, it could be the 4th of July. Could be a reminder of what happened there. So the clearly things that are done with breathing, some intervention, meditation, mindfulness meditation, which for me still have something to do with that breathing. And then the others that are using music therapy. Music has been used a lot too. And we all know people use music when they start to feel very anxious. And I say very anxious is because PTSD was originally an anxiety disorder. But because classifications are always move around, it was shifted. But it was originally an anxiety disorder. So the first thing that you can feel when you're exposed to something that reminds you of the trauma is that anxiety that starts to go up. So for those who use music, meditation, or breathing, studies have shown that that can help with that physiological response.
I have a question.
I hope that
Go
answered your
ahead.
questions. Go ahead.
What percentage of our population struggles with PTSD?
Oh, that's a good question. In the military, the data it's about 12, 16, and the data changes all the time. So I want anybody to be able to look this up online, but it's around that 10% if you count people who went to the military. The civilian population, the data is increasing now because I don't think we've checked since COVID. Since COVID, I don't know if we've looked at new numbers because what happened during COVID, it wasn't just the COVID disease. It was people who had to stay in environment that were not healthy for them. They had to, how did we call that again? When people had to stay together, there was confinement. I don't know if the word is confinement. Yeah.
Quarantine.
Thank you, quarantine. So people had to stay in an environment that were they couldn't flee those environment. I heard report of women who could not ask for divorce. Lawyers were busy, psychologists were busy, so they didn't get any help, whether to flee the situation or to help get help while in the situation. So there was a lot of unexpected consequences to COVID that I believe have increased this prevalence or incidence if we do, if it's the numbers are checked again.
So, a question I have is, when did PTSD first come into the medical literature? I mean, when was that? I mean, certainly in my early years in the healthcare field, to be honest with you, I'd never even heard of it. And then, when was it officially a diagnosis? Do you have an idea on that?
The numbers, No, that's a good question. I'm going to look for it too. All I know is that it started in the military, but it wasn't even called PTSD at the time. They just noticed that this veteran had a different name. I should have prepared for that. I should have prepared for that history. Yes, Dr. Bailey.
Shell, it was called like shell shock.
Exactly.
Shell shock,
Shell shock, which actually goes back certainly
A
to
long
World
way,
War
but
One. Some of the historical,
Well, if we find the answer, we can get it in
Thank
our
you.
research for the show for sure.
The Vietnam War, I think the people were already having shell shock. So they started that, and then first it was even after they came up with the name PTSD, it was still very military, right? Well, it actually opened up to the general to civilians and recognizing other types of trauma because they saw a the similarity with the symptoms, right? So
So here's maybe a final question. When people are diagnosed with PTSD, what are they treat? Are they treated for that and for their comorbid
yeah.
indications that they have? In other words, okay, my goodness, you have an increase, heart disease. Okay, and you also have PTSD. So what are they tr who treats them, or is it kind of a combination between their mental health providers and their internists or cardiologists in this case?
That's a great question. And one of the reasons why I do the research that I do in these young women is I want to say, hey, look here. Please don't overlook these women. Don't think they're fine and you keep talking about menopause. Please look at these women too. Something is happening here. But the real we should have it, the approach here, and we talk a lot about individualization of medicine. There shouldn't be one size fit all. And
Yeah,
clearly
yeah.
the clinical psychologist cannot handle internal medicine problem. So it's a team approach
It's a team,
to
yeah.
a team approach to care, but with communication.
Yeah.
When I have a participant who come in my study because they have trouble sleeping, and because I also study sleep, sleep is one of the first thing. If you have any type of trauma, sleep is the first thing to, peaceful sleep is the first thing to go.
Yeah.
Because even nightmare of the event will prevent you from sleeping. And when that happens, people don't want to sleep. So when a participant comes to me and is really interested in the sleep part of my study, and I say, well, we can really separate that. We can handle your sleep as if it was a separate thing to the traumatic experience. There should be some communication with your therapist.
Absolutely, a connection.
Sleep with the,
Yeah.
talk to the sleep physician, because the reason why you're not sleeping, it's not the same thing that we see in other people. Maybe they have obstructive sleep apnea, but
Right.
your cause of not sleeping is this different issue. So I feel like there should be a team approach. Is it the case for what I'm seeing for my participant? Unfortunately, not. It's a lot of disjointed approach. One person is sending, it's the whole body. You know,
Correct. Yeah.
PTSD touches everything, so we need to handle it together.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great point. And it also begs more, frankly, not only this, but in many, many medical situations, a better coordinated approach for team approach for treatment. Wow, this is, it's a complicated subject. It's a sad subject, but Ida, I certainly compliment you for tackling it. And addressing it, and hopefully we'll be getting more and more information as your research unfolds. Clarence, last thoughts.
Davida, thank you. It has been a pleasure listening to you, and I look forward to hearing you. I listen forward to the recording. So, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Barry, last thoughts.
I have a couple of things. This was, you know, this was fabulous. And one of the things why I think it's so important is that PTSD usually is always seems to me is characterized as mental health problems. And we all know that mental health treatments and resources for that tend to not be enough for what we need. And now, if we can really link it to some of the physiological and comorbidity issues that your research is pinpointing, it really puts it more in the medical mainstream, which I think is potentially a positive for having more directed and active treatment for this, and understanding that it's more than, you know, it's not in your head, and it's not that you're losing sleep. It's that you're having a high blood pressure, and ultimately with more strokes and heart attacks and all these other things. So I think this does open the window potentially for understanding that this is a lot bigger than we thought it was. And your research, your great research on that, really is demonstrating that. And then just a last thing is, I'd love to have the playlist for not the placebo group, but for the group that did the deep breathing, because that really seems to be, you know, okay. I know it's not going to be my granddaughter's rap music that she wants to play for me. I don't think, but you know, I'm not sure. So if you could share that playlist, that would be
I
great.
wish I could. I think the respiratory
Okay.
device people would make that probably have the copyright to the
Oh,
music
okay.
that is in their device. But yeah, definitely we should be able, you know, people who exercise have this. The type of music for every state of the, you know,
I need
high
something to just
tempo.
work with breathing. That would be great.
Yeah.
And so
Deep,
thank you
deep
so
breathing
much. It was
music.
really great
Thank you. And
to
one thing about this notion I want to hammer that PTSD is not only in the head, is because in minority community and in African communities where I come from, we grow up being taught to just push it under the carpet, if I may, you know, for lack of a better word. It's fine, just get over it. Just get over it. Just get over it. We don't really recognize. We We think it's in your head, it's just in your head. If you get over it, you'll be fine. But I'm really trying to show that as many, we've had books like The Body Keeps a Score. I really want to show that when, even if you think you can get over it without going through proper care, seeing a therapist, seeing a physician, if you have certain symptoms that are new to you and that are, scary to you, because people who have their heart skipping beats, that can be scary, go to the doctor. Even if you didn't have a family history of hypertension or a family history of diabetes, research is showing that PTSD alone can be the reason why you develop those diseases.
Yeah, and it can exacerbate it.
It can exacerbate. You look healthy, you're fit,
Right. Yeah.
but still, because you're not taking care of that mental health issue, it's spreading.
Yeah,
And
the underlying issue
exactly.
is what's causing, yeah.
Yeah,
Wow, I
exactly.
really, really thank you for your insight, for your research and addressing the questions around PTSD that are frankly much more complicated than probably most of us think. So thank you for being on Health Chatter. We invite you to share your research. We can get that on our website as you
Oh,
get more
thank you.
information. So that'll be wonderful. So Ida, thank you. Thank you so much for addressing this problem on Health Chatter with us today. We have great shows coming up. Our next show will be on men's stories about health, which also should be an interesting subject. So, for all of you in Health Chatterland, keep health chatting away.